Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
The city 5 years ago today was utterly insolvent by any definition of what these guys call insolvent. Running cash flow deficits, not being able to meet your debts as they come due, borrowing money, as Sheila said, on credit cards to keep the lights on, even with all the pain of laying off public safety officers that made the town more violent or permitted it to become more violent. So at the time, at June 30th, 13, when we got the audit done a year later, it confirmed that the city was in deficit of $133 million. But only in government finance, I'm a turnaround guy by training, not I've only found government in two cities. Only in government accounting does borrow money count as a revenue. So as the city borrowed money on these credit cards, it counts as revenue, and the fund balance would have been nearly $1 billion at that point. Again, as Doug told me a long time ago, not for the faint of heart. I was personally sued by the bond insurers alongside Kevin. I had faith that being sued alongside a Jones Day partner would end probably okay, and it did, you know. So it's a big fight. I mean, there's people shooting at you. When you borrow money, you should expect to pay it back, and when you don't, you're going to meet angry people. To put numbers to what Sheila said, think of what really caused this. The city went from 1.8 million residents in 1950 to 700,000 residents at the time of the filing. Mayor Duggan likes to say the reason we see blight in our city is that when those million people left, they didn't take their houses with them. You know, those got left behind, and those are the things that the land bank is dealing with today and has had to grow up very quickly. I mean, our land bank has 95,000 properties. That's more properties than exist in the entire city of Dearborn that's owned by a governmental agency. So the residents leaving started it. The numbers confirmed it. The bankruptcy was a fight. As we all now know, it was December 10th of 2014 when we finally exited bankruptcy. So we're only at 3.5 years post-bankruptcy. And what permitted the city to run and restore service, remember Judge Rhodes said, he also ruled that the city was in a state of service insolvency, an inability to provide adequate services to its residents. No lights in the neighborhood, no police on the streets, firefighters and EMS providers that couldn't get there in the time that residents expect. So bankruptcy's tough. I mean, everyone got represented. The retiree committee hired counsel. The city paid for that counsel. So this was a big fight. The judges did, you know, which is now history, a brilliant job of forcing people in mediation. All of you that, if you live in the litigation world, you know that as soon as you file a suit, the next step is going to be the judge is going to try to convince you to mediate your dispute so he doesn't have to issue tough rulings that might not stand up on appeal. So that whole year of December of 2013, once we were eligible, to December of 14, was negotiating consensual settlements with residents or creditors that everybody signed up for. So at the end of the day, when you strip it all away and you say, why does the city have money today when it didn't have money in the past? It's because we reduced obligations, and I've got a scorecard. We eliminated $7.2 billion worth of debt. The biggest hit in the bankruptcy was the retirees. You know, I'm the city's bond guy, so when I'm in public markets, you know, bondholders and bond insurers still, you know, it's tough to sit on panels with them. But I will tell you that, and these numbers prove it out, the OPEB liability to retirees was $3.8 billion of that $7.2. Our retirees today, we do have four different VEBA trusts, so two for general, two for police and fire, one for people that retired before 14, one after, so a lot of complexity. But the benefits these VEBAs deliver are a fraction. Even calling it a fraction is calling it too much. A very small amount to take away some of the pain, so that's all retirees get. And they gave up $3.8 billion in liability. Pension reductions, and RJ said, this was the toughest thing. I mean, we all had family members during it that said, how can you be doing this to retirees? And So we now know what happened. The general retirees had a 4.5% cut in their pensions, and they lost entirely their cost of living allowance. And police and fire retirees lost half of their COLA. So those pension reductions were $1.7 billion. The people that it sounds like Pat consulted with, that were very angry with us, believe me, dealing with foreign banks who bought this debt in good faith, it's not easy when you're not going to pay them back. That reduction was $1.3 billion. And I know there was the whole argument that it was illegal debt back when it was, issued, and, you can debate that all day long. But at the end of the day, those people agreed to take a cut of $1.3 billion. And then there were the swaps, the derivatives that surrounded the pension obligation certificates. That was a $200 million hit. So a $7.2 billion hit. I think the retirees negotiated a good deal. Our retirement systems are far from out of the woods, but they're being run very responsibly today. Our police and fire retirement system has $3 billion in assets. But if you take all the benefits that's promised to those 12,000 retirees and present value it, it's a $4 billion liability. So we've still got to close the gap on $1 billion during the lifetime of those 12,000 retirees that are counting on their new deal of what they've been promised. On the general retirement side, we've got $2 billion in assets, and the present value of the liability is $3 billion. So we're $1 billion short there as well. There's more general retirees. There's 18,000 general retirees. So there's still 30,000 retirees that are counting on getting paid those reduced benefits for the rest of their life. So being on the pension boards is a big responsibility. You don't see, like Sheila said, if you go back to past administrations, the media had fun covering just all the antics of people on these boards and former mayors influencing investments that pension funds should have never, ever been invested in. Now we've got professional investment committees that run this. Our deal with the foundations is going good. I'm the compliance person for the Foundation for Detroit's Future. We file all the reports that Doug wrote into the legal language that we had to file with them for the rest of their obligation. So the money comes in as it's supposed to from the foundations, have made good on theirs. The retirement systems are running responsibly. All 30,000 retirees are getting paid every single month. So I'm kind of proud that we've now returned, law and order to how those pension funds are being run. So it did hurt to watch retirees get hurt. I say publicly all the time, if you want to ask me who took the biggest hit, no question, it was the retirees. They're the ones that gave to restore this service restoration that you now see. And, it's wonderful to see. What's fun today is, and a lot of you probably in the room know the mayor. The mayor is one of the strongest leaders I've ever run across, and a lot of people will tell you that. He's metrics driven every Wednesday, not this Wednesday because I'm here, but every Wednesday, everybody from director level on up goes to a cabinet meeting. You've got to show your metrics. He wants to know response times. He's got metrics for every single department. He's brought his lean people from the medical center here to help the city run better. So it is running, no question, it's running a lot better, but it's because the city has the breathing room. What Sheila went through for all of us that are turnaround people, that's the agonizing time when you're trying to do less with less and it's a zero-sum game. You've got to figure out who's going to get hurt. So I hope that answers your question.
That was great. Thank you. Pat, talk about your position in the bankruptcy and representing your clients, and there's only so much money to go around in those kinds of situations. You've been through a lot of them, but just sort of talk about what was your game plan throughout this whole process.
Well, it was kind of interesting. So if you look, I'm a big advocate. I think the emergency manager law is a good law, because as Sheila pointed out, sometimes the governance doesn't have, for a variety of reasons, the ability to move quick and take necessary action. And the emergency manager law allows you to do that. As it was implemented, though, there's always there's an 18-month window for which action needed to be resolved. And I suppose when it was enacted, it was a little bit like General Patton's view, which was a good plan quickly executed was better than the best plan that was executed too late. And so, it required a lot of quick action. Our representation of the Certificate of Participation bondholders was very interesting. We were engaged by one of their consultants for our local real estate expertise on the city, and they were looking for an alternative recovery mechanism since they were only being offered 10 cents on a dollar, which, you know, was $150 million on a $1.5 billion obligation, and they thought that was wholly inadequate. So Mike Deegan and I worked with the national consulting firm, and we pie charted, or I should say pin charted, all the real estate owned that the city of Detroit had, which, if you remember seeing in the papers, was 88,000 parcels. So we had these massive, you know, pin chart. And what we said to the cop bondholders is that if you look at the Detroit budget, and I think this is probably my biggest criticism of the bankruptcy, because I don't think it went far enough. And maybe it was because of time, maybe it was because it was led by legal and financial engineers. But it was a huge opportunity missed for what I believe will impact the sustainability of Detroit, in that 60 to 75% of revenues that are in every city budget are driven by property taxes. So you have to have a good property tax base in order to move forward. I would argue the bankruptcy did nothing for that. So here you have the city of Detroit sitting on 88,000 vacant parcels. They own a half interest in a tunnel. They own an airport. They have riverfront property. And the chart showed that between Grand Boulevard and 8 Mile, around the Mound Ryan area, there were many vacant industrial warehouse zone space. So our approach to the cap bondholders was, you should bid in for all 88,000 parcels for $100 million. Nobody's going to pay attention to that. It'll sound like a big number, and people will be happy that you're willing to sell your claim, cost the city nothing. But what you ask for is the entitlements necessary to develop that. And we'll bring the development community to it, because a lot of times developers are having a hard time within the city because of all the bureaucracy and levels of approvals you have to get. And in the real estate development business, time is money. And so it discourages developers from wanting to put money at risk to develop. But if you can get it with the entitlements, that's a great start. Second part is that you've got environmental liabilities. And, you know, the city has the ability to potentially push many of these parcels through the land bank and take that risk off the table. So if you could get the ability to develop with the proper entitlements, zoning, and not have to worry about the environmental liabilities, now you've got a real asset. Because people that would be interested in developing within the city would find this a very attractive piece. And you don't have to worry about developing it. There'll be many developers that'll be highly interested in that, because they've all had the horror stories. And if you also look at the riverfront, because our vision was Detroit should be an international distribution center. Mm-hmm. When you think about all the access that we have, you know, with the bridges, the tunnels, the waterway, and the fact that there's three railroads that operate a spur downriver, which gives rail a unique advantage that you can actually competitively bid moving goods by rail, which is not true in many parts of the United States, that Detroit really could be set up as an international distribution center, and that would create tax base for the city moving forward. And Commerce and DEPFA were highly interested in that, and they controlled most of the debt, but they didn't control all of it. And we were flown to New York. We made a presentation at the Sheraton New York, and, you know, we laid out our vision. And one of the advantages, and again, I would call this as a criticism, was not having enough local players in the Detroit bankruptcy. They brought in a guy from St. Louis who had done some urban development, and he got the stage first. And for 20 minutes, he, you know, gave this presentation, and somebody stood up from one of the banks. We had all the banks there and probably 50 attorneys in the room to hear this presentation. And he says, well, what's cool about Detroit? And he says, oh, you should see what's going on. They got these pop-up stores going up in this. And I'm going, pop-up stores, really? I mean, we're trying to talk about billions of dollars of tax base that we're trying to generate here, and you're here to talk about pop-up stores? And, you know, when I got the mic, I said, this is, you know, Detroit needs to be, and this is a great opportunity in bankruptcy, to position it as an international distribution center. And we kind of walked through the whole presentation. Well, Mike Deegan and I, we left after we made our presentations. You know, we were asked because they had other to be excused because they had other business to cover. And the guys from Commerce and DEPFA Bank came out in the hall, and they said, we like this plan. And they said, we're I think Duffel Bank might have been having a little financial trouble at the time, but Commerce Bank was pretty strong. They said, we'd be willing to invest a couple hundred million. We don't want to necessarily reposition this and walk away. We would actually back some people within the Detroit development community to do some of these things that you're talking about. But he says, you know, we're like herding cats in there, and they were arguing as to some of the banks needed to have some kind of liquidation event. Others were willing to go long term. If you notice the way the bankruptcy settled for, I believe it might have been Cencora, and maybe there was one other one, is they did take some parcels of real estate. I think one of them took a big parking garage. Somebody took some riverfront. So they did start to focus on the real estate, but in the smallest of ways. And my view is that, while I know there's been a lot of chest beating about how great the City of Detroit bankruptcy was and how it really did a lot of great things, I believe it's an opportunity miss. I think it's the emperor's new clothes, in my opinion, for the simple reason that the city's survival is going to depend on tax base, plain and simple. And so the inability at this juncture to develop that, I think, is going to slow down. Now, I think the bankruptcy has provided great financial runway to deal with some of the legacy issues that John talked about and defer some of these obligations and eliminate a large portion of others. But the fundamental problem has not been addressed, and that is developing tax base within the city. While you look at all the great things that are going on in the downtown area, which is great, and there's a body of people that think you start with core cities and you kind of build out that way, and arguably that's the way Detroit was built. I mean, if you look at how Detroit was really adopted with the French view of the spoke wheel concept in terms of roads that lead out, everything leads out from the central city. You've got Michigan Avenue going one direction, Woodward Avenue, Jefferson. Everything leads out from the core city. But that's a very, very long-term strategy. And, the ability to attract retail is a function of rooftops, people actually living in houses, and the ability to do that is a function of having good employment opportunities within the city, but more importantly, good public services and public education, which arguably Mayor Duggan has done a much, much, much better job on public services. Public education still has a long way to go. So unless that part of the puzzle gets fixed, in my opinion, it will continue to retard the development opportunities and growth within the city that will drive tax base. And I think that was a big opportunity missed within the bankruptcy.
Great, thank you. Doug, what was going on in your world as this bankruptcy was going through? And, it's almost like you're in a bubble, so to speak, and you've got all these moving parts around you, but you've got to just focus on...
Let's put it in perspective. So in 2012, the state was embroiled in several cities and school districts that were in trouble. And the emergency manager law was developing. And with all these municipalities or municipal bodies in trouble, the state came up with a program that said, we've got all these potential places that need emergency managers, but nobody's ever done the training for them. We're going to do a training program for potential emergency managers. And I get a call to participate in the training program, and my assignment is municipal bankruptcy, Chapter 9. A chapter of the bankruptcy code that at the time, I had been practicing 31 years, never read. It's not taught. It's 11 pages, I think, with annotations. And the problem for anybody involved in municipal bankruptcy is there's no roadmap. For lawyers, we rely on case law and statutes. There is no case law. There are no reported decisions on municipal bankruptcy because they are so rare. There's been fewer than 100 in history. So there's no roadmap, and it's okay. I'm going to teach people about a statute or a series of statutes that I've never read, that's never really been interpreted other than one-offs. And the one thing you could learn is every municipal bankruptcy is different. Far and away, Detroit's issues were far more complex than any other municipal bankruptcy that had been filed in America. So, with that background, because I had trained these potential emergency managers and then got called on to do a second panel for a bigger population of potential emergency managers, I became known as a municipal bankruptcy expert. Well, I'm here to tell you, in I think late 2013, I remember sitting on a panel at the Michigan Municipal League, and I made an admission, as I am announced as or introduced as a municipal bankruptcy expert, said, folks, you know, you all run cities and you're involved in city government. I have to admit to you, until the Detroit bankruptcy, I was tied in a number of municipal bankruptcies I was involved in with Miguel Cabrera and my dog. Truth of the matter is, we kind of know bankruptcy. We've been at it for a while. The difference is, when you're dealing with a company, they have a product to sell. And if the bankruptcy fails, they can go out of business. The city can't go out of business. The product to sell, however, is things like Pat's talking about. A good business environment, safe schools, quality education, safe streets, street lights. And that had to be addressed. What did happen, though, on the day of the bankruptcy, as I'm, you know, I've got all this expertise in municipal bankruptcy, somehow I got to be the spokesperson for interpreting municipal bankruptcy, and I get called upon to do a bunch of interviews. The day after the city filed, I did 17 interviews. The day they filed, and the moment they filed, within the next half hour, I think I did, well, first of all, I was live by phone on the television news for the next 35 minutes and then had to get downtown because they wanted me live on the news. I'm dressed casually. I got to run home and put on a suit. In the interim, I get 4 calls and do interviews from national and local media. Now, here's what struck me the next day. First of all, overnight, I get a call from a producer at CNN that we're flying in. Can you meet us tomorrow morning? Well, okay, here's another admission. The morning after, I'm sitting in my underwear. It's about 5:30 in the morning. I'm doing a radio interview. Yeah. You know, what you don't see on radio is a good thing. So then I went downtown. I did the local news. And here's what struck me. I'm meeting a CNN crew outside the Maccabees building on Woodward. They've got a satellite truck. And there's a news crew from Japan that's sharing the satellite truck with them. I thought, why do you care? Well, what I came to learn throughout the bankruptcy was, including at the first hearing I attended, I'm standing in the security line to go into the courthouse. And there's a woman in front of me who turns to me as we're standing outside because the line's so long. And she says, are you with the government? And I'm thinking, well, that's something nobody's ever asked me before. And hopefully they never will again. But no, why do you ask? Well, it turns out this lady was a reporter from a news outlet in Brazil. And she was there to cover. And I said, why are you here? And she said, there are 3 cities in America that everybody's interested in: New York, Washington, and Detroit. And it came to me, the longer I went through the process with all these interview requests, they came from throughout the world. I appeared on French television live twice debating some people in a studio in Paris about who's at fault for Detroit's bankruptcy and is it fair for the pensioners to take the hit when you've got all these bankers. I talked to the BBC, I don't know how many times on a show called, I don't know, must be up all night, because it's 3:30 in the morning there, and I'm thinking, well, there's some sheep farmer driving through the countryside listening to me talk about Detroit's bankruptcy. Why do you care? But I talked to people from Japan. I talked to people from Belgium. I talked to people from Brazil, France, and they're all interested in Detroit's survival. And that is something, being a lifelong resident, that I didn't realize. And I came to appreciate that they really cared and they wanted to see Detroit succeed. And I think that interest is still there. And no bankruptcy is perfect, including this one. But the city's a lot better off for it and really didn't have much in the way of alternatives. And every good bankruptcy is based upon compromise. And while the Grand Bargain is a remarkable arrangement, which was never before thought of in any bankruptcy context and probably won't happen in the future, the people who really should be thanked for their sacrifice in the success of the Detroit bankruptcy are the pensioners. Because without them approving the plan of adjustment, the Grand Bargain money was not available. And the city owes a huge debt of gratitude to them. And they did nothing wrong.
Okay, thank you. Sheila, in the context of what Pat was saying earlier about the assets that the city had and still has in terms of land, today, I think roughly the city owns about 30% of the 139 square miles. You know, the lights are on and things are working better. But in your mind, what still needs to be done or what can be done to improve things and to bring more tax revenue to the city?
Well, thank you, RJ. I think Pat's point about the tax base is absolutely spot on. And sort of the narrative we have right now about Detroit's comeback kind of gets lost in the shuffle. And for the report that was done for the Revenue Estimating Conference in February of 2018, Mr. Klein indicates that in this era, the property taxes accounted for only 12% of the city's general fund revenues. Most cities that work, well, I mean, Dearborn, 95% of their general fund comes from their tax base because of Ford's presence there. But the average of all cities in the state is 43%. This is a structural issue that has not yet been addressed. I would love to see your plan. I think that, you know, the work you did, I don't know if it's proprietary or not, but that's the kind of thinking that needs to go along with some of the other work that is being done for the administration. I think the focus by both the business community and the mayor on workforce development is really huge. This is really, I mean, the years I was on council, it literally was mainly a friends and family employment program. If you knew the right person, you got a hookup to be a navigator in which you sat with somebody and helped them dress for success or write a resume or some other stuff that really is not the core things that people who have lived. We're talking now the fourth or fifth generation of people in Detroit who have lived in grinding poverty. They have lived in spatial, psychological, emotional, intellectual isolation. It is at their expense that the suburbs have been able to become as wealthy and successful as they have been because of the migration of this capital out. So to address this network of problems, the restructuring of workforce development is absolutely, I think, core, because that's now where people are going to not be taught how to dress for success, but give people the tools that they need to get a real job that has a real opportunity for that person and their family to get up and out of poverty. I agree wholeheartedly that what the Detroit Education Commission is a really critical first step, where an attempt to kind of coordinate the combination of the private, not the private schools so much as the charters and the public schools, is really important. Education in the state with the charter school movement has basically turned into an economic development program for people who want to use the dollars associated with children, and certainly in Detroit. There are school districts in the state, in this region, who have more Detroit children in their districts than they have children of their own neighborhood, of their own community. That is not helping the Detroit public school system. So creating a structure that begins to coordinate the relationships is a really important other step. That I think those are the and I think Dr. Vitti has brought in a wonderful academic team. One of the problems of emergency management, for 15 years, the cabinet who was in charge of Detroit public schools did not have an academic person on it. It was all operations people. When Alicia Merriweather came in, she had me bring Citizen Detroit in. We do a history of the DPS, and have created a board game. She had us do it with her group because she wanted to find a way to reintegrate academic people with the operations people because they had been disconnected for 15 years. How do you run a school system without academic leadership being in the core cabinet and think you're going to produce anything other than the results that have been produced? So the VD is absolutely essential. What he's doing, he's got a crackerjack team of people who care about kids first. It's not about contracts. And you have the mayor, and the emphasis on workforce development is really important. So the Renaissance story is fabulous. I think Ford's move here is an iconic move for the city and for them. I think that there's a chance here to be able to create a new paradigm for bringing back a city that has been in decline, a new roadmap for urban revitalization. But it's going to require dealing with the reality that there are two Detroits. We can paper it over if we want, but there are two Detroits. I'm a retiree in the city of Detroit. I talk to people every day. There are people who are not off in their golden years going to Florida in the winter and traveling in the summer. They're getting a third job at FedEx, the good places to work. They have to because of the cut in their pension. And I don't know how the VIBAs are supposed to work for the health care, but I can tell you this. I go to a doctor. My thing to them is, hey, look, I have no damn idea what this is going to cost. Submit it and see what they'll pay, and I'll wait for the god-awful bill that I'm going to get. My personal out-of-pocket costs for health care go up on a monthly basis. That's the reality for who made the biggest contribution to the grand bargain, to take nothing away from how phenomenal it was, what incredible significance the Ford Foundation, Kresge, others have played in making that happen. But the reality is there are Detroiters today who every single day pay the price for the grand bargain working, because we did vote. We had to vote. We made the sacrifice. We voted ourselves to take these cuts. So we shouldn't be forgotten. And I don't think that people intentionally try to forget, but we've got to make sure the narrative addresses the core divisions so that we can get really to the point where we not only have a city that flourishes, but a region.
Great, thank you. Well, we have about 8 minutes left, and Vicki, we're going to turn things over to you to begin the Q&A.
All right, great. Good morning, everybody. Vicki Thomas from WWJ Radio. Great to be here this morning. If you have a question, raise your hand and I will get to you. I'm going to take the moderator's privilege, though, and ask the first question. I wanted to follow up on something that you said, Pat, that the bankruptcy didn't go far enough. Do you think, in terms of improving the city's tax base, that the land bank is doing all it can to help put people in the homes? I think it was just yesterday they had the Occupied Home Buyer Program where people got the deeds to their home. They have the auction. Do those go far enough, or is it just not enough?
I guess, Vicki, that's a good question, and I would say that it's, you need a lot more than just that. I mean, some of the infrastructure problems, I can't remember if it was John or Sheila were talking about, is that when you have a city the size of Detroit, in order to deliver public services efficiently, you have to have a critical mass of residential development that you can service efficiently. Because when you're trying to cover 138 square miles like Detroit is, it's difficult when you have disparate populations. So I think the land bank is a good start to that. But again, if you look at the city today, and you've got the center core, which is growing employment and development, people are mostly still commuters. And nobody's putting a stake ground in Detroit from a residential basis. When you look at the current rental housing in Detroit is almost 100% occupied. with square foot rents that are off the charts from whatever we've seen. However, that's not true for sale housing. And the reason for that is you buy, say, a new condominium over at Brush Park and pay $250,000 to $300,000, your resale value is almost 30% less than that, because now you've got a used product and there's still no reason for people to drop anchor in Detroit. They want services, they want to be able to educate their kids and that. So Detroit, more than ever, has probably become a commuter city until those basic core services get fixed. The way to fix them is by having, you know, money in a plan, money derived from property tax base. I live in Troy. I love Troy. The city of tomorrow today is their motto. We have an unbelievable business tax base there, which allows us to have great schools, which allows us to have great amenities within the city. It's all driven by tax base. And Detroit is going to have a very difficult time really getting, being something other than a downtown area until they figure the other aspects out.
That's a great segue. My name is Eric Lufer. I'm the president of the Citizens Research Council of Michigan, and I want to ask a question about the future, which I think that's a great segue. There's a recession coming. I don't know when, I don't know how soon, but it's coming. Is the city prepared for that? Does it have the cash in the bank? Is it prepared when income tax revenues go down, as we know they will? They always go down. Now city more dependent on income tax revenues. And in asking this question, it strikes me, if you say that they are, Detroit might be the only city in Michigan prepared, given the way that we're doing municipal finance in the state. So let me just...
I can speak to that. So one of the things that came from the grand bargain, so money from foundations in the state always comes with strings attached. In this case, we had a lot to do with defining what those strings look like. And I'll start with the law. So Public Act 181 and 182 set up a financial governance structure that even after we're gone from our positions at the city, others will have to follow. And that uses, you know, Nick Corey, our state treasurer's rule number one for local government finances, have a multi-year plan. Even though you know it's going to be wrong, if you don't have a multi-year plan, you'll have no ability to plan for those pinch points. So the city's required to have a four-year plan. That four-year plan starts every year with a revenue estimating conference, which is clearly a best practice in government. It's not optional. It's required for the city of Detroit. So twice a year we convene, and Sheila was quoting from it, Michigan State professors, you know, help with an economic outlook. We've now in Detroit built our own economic team that does economic forecasting Detroit specific. We think the state level is too macro for us, so we're really into this forecasting stuff now. We're even building, it's just about done, a 10-year plan, so we're looking out over a long time horizon. What Pat said does hurt. Property taxes are number four revenue. The other three are really healthy, though. One of the things we did, and it was Andy Dillon when he was state treasurer that pushed for this during the bankruptcy, the city of Detroit's income tax is now processed by the state of Michigan. So when we file our Michigan returns, Detroit goes right along with it. So we are seeing big gains in income taxes as a result of the development you see downtown Midtown. Number two revenue source is state revenue sharing. It's something you always have to watch carefully. It probably had a hand in Detroit's demise when the state cut it, so we stay very vigilant on that. Number three is the wagering tax. That's been a very dependable tax. Every day, all three casinos wire to us essentially 12% of their net gaming revenue, so that's $185 million. So the fact that property tax revenue in the $120 million range is number four, it does hurt. We know we can't impact it right away. The mayor's answer to what Pat talked about is what's called Strategic Neighborhood Fund 2.0. He believes strongly, and we do as well, that the city has to develop outside of downtown and midtown. So if you look at Strategic Neighborhood Fund 2.0, it's 12 areas of the city that used to have commercial sectors, doubling down on those, doing the planning for those now. We borrowed $125 million from Chase Bank last year for the infrastructure improvements and trying to create those neighborhoods of density. The mayor would tell you that going back to the old-fashioned, we're not going to beat the suburbs at the suburb strategy. You know, what Pat probably likes about Troy is a suburban neighborhood where everybody's got their home and keeps their, you know, grass cut, and there's a neighborhood association. That's not for Detroit. We're trying to build neighborhoods of density. The mayor believes that if it's done around vibrant, walkable downtowns, and Detroit used to have those neighborhoods in the 139 square miles, we had those neighborhoods. So the strategy really is to develop the tax base, but it's to roll out to these other target neighborhoods. What we learned, and now that we have a greater partnership with the foundations are contributing to that. That fund, it's a $130 million fund that our development officer, Ryan Fredericks, is trying to raise. It provides the funding for the development in those neighborhoods. It's not bankable. So there is a development gap in Detroit. It's no secret to everybody in this room. So the way we're closing it is with philanthropic money being the first layer and then adding on top of it. So we do plan to grow the neighborhoods that way. And then, as you know, probably many people in the room know, both the mayor and Tom LaWand are always very, very active in recruiting businesses to Detroit. So we'll hope to grow our way out of it. We feel like we're fortunate that a lot of the inner ring suburbs have nowhere to go. As you say, if the property taxes fall again for those cities, it's most of their revenue, as Sheila said. So in that regard, even though it's number four, it kind of better prepares us to not be hurt by as much by the next recession. Income taxes may go down, but the development we're seeing is not just one or two developers. We're seeing a broad base of developers that are willing to come into even the neighborhoods.
And Vicki, this will have to be the last one.
Hi, Larry Gardner, Lawrence Gardner Associates. Unlike Doug and Pat, we tend to represent the distraught, unsecured borrower. And I remember, Doug, if I correctly, perhaps 2 years before the bankruptcy, you served on a panel at the in Southfield at the hotel there in terms of whether Detroit was going to enter bankruptcy. But so I have a question for Pat, who said in terms of the bondholders having swaths of property along the riverfront, what's happening with the Joe Louis Arena that I understand was one of those that they took as collateral? Is there any plans to, after it's torn down, to develop that?
Larry, honestly, I have not followed through the status of the Joe Louis proposed development.
I think answer that, though.
Go ahead.
That was part of the settlement with FGIC, which was the second largest creditor. Under the plan, the city was responsible for the demolition. FGIC had to develop the project as mixed use, including a hotel, within 3 years. They have they've actually filed the lawsuit to extend the time, and there is a solicitation for developers. The biggest concern currently is they're not sure, because of where the property's situated, that it's ripe for a hotel. So there's some negotiation ongoing as far as that parcel goes, but that was actually the last piece of the settlement of the bankruptcy to get the plan adjusted. They were the last creditor.
Yeah, I'll just add from the city side, we are working on a demolition plan for Joe Louis Arena right now. You'll recall the state made a $6 million commitment for demolition. The repayment of that would come out of the plan, a brownfield plan. So that plan, in fact, is going to city council this week without a specific development yet known. So our corporation council is continuing to work with FGIC. But in the meantime, on the city side, we're doing our part in working through the demo plan, which is complicated. As you know, it's tightly packed in there. It's on an international border. There's laws from Canada as it relates to what you can do demo-wise. So it's a complicated demolition, but our the Detroit Building Authority is working on that plan right now.
Okay, great. Before we get to giving away some raffle prizes, please join me in thanking our esteemed panel for their presentations.
Spring is a time of renewal, so why not refresh your home with a little help from Blinds.com? We make getting custom window treatments a minor project with major impact. Choose from premium blinds, shades, and shutters. We even have options for your patio, too. Blinds.com invented a better way to shop for custom window treatments. There's no pushy salespeople in your home or inflated showroom prices. Our design experts can help you find the perfect window treatments on your schedule. We'll even send free samples directly to you. Plus, we can handle the measuring and installation for you. Unlimited window treatments installed for just one low cost. And with Blinds.com, you'll always get transparent pricing. No hidden fees. Our free shipping and 100% satisfaction guarantee can put the spring back into your step. And into your home, too. Shop Blinds.com right now and save up to 40%. Up to 40% off for a limited time at Blinds.com. Blinds.com. Rules and restrictions may apply.